The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article is from the health column, My Heart Will Go On. A medical journalist's surprise heart attack reveals how much she didn't know about the number one killer of women and men. By Melinda Lawrence. I'm lying in a hospital bed trying to process what happened, but all I can focus on are popular song titles, Miley Cyrus and Mark Ronson's Nothing Breaks Like a Heart, Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On, Blondie's Heart of Glass, The Bee Gees' How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, Sting's Be Still My Beating Heart. No, not that last one. The last thing I want is for my heart to be still. Please, please, please keep beating. It's only been a few days since I was taking advantage of a gorgeous September Friday to play hooky. I decided to leave my home office to wander around New York City and then to make up the work time over the weekend. The day had been perfect. I got a free facial offered by a cosmetics company in Herald Square. I ate a delicious chopped salad for lunch at one of my favorite restaurants. I used a gift card I'd carried around for months to get some new lingerie. Then, as I was feeling perfectly content, wondering what to do next, I felt a strange sensation in my chest. It wasn't painful. It was just weird. And somehow it also felt deeply, seriously wrong. It felt as if someone had taken an elastic bandage and wrapped it around my chest. A tightness, though not overly tight. And I was overcome with a feeling of almost existential dread, as if that elastic bandage, meant to heal, was going to kill me. I walked to the train station and headed home. Once there, I drank some water, then sat on the couch, trying to breathe deeply and stay calm. Soon the strange feeling disappeared, and I tried to forget it had ever happened. But over the course of the weekend, it would return briefly, then disappear again. Each time the tightness returned, I panicked. And then, when it disappeared, I felt relieved and tried to convince myself it was gone for good. But I knew it wasn't. So, without a word to my husband, I drove myself to the local emergency room, half believing they'd tell me I was being ridiculous and that all I was suffering from was indigestion. Or maybe gas. Anything but a heart attack. In fact, I was in such denial that I even thought about walking to the emergency room, which was over 2 miles away, just to get in my daily exercise. In the end, common sense won, and I drove. The ER reception desk staff didn't assume I had indigestion. As soon as they heard me say chest tightness, they ushered me into an examining room and hooked me up to an electrocardiogram machine. Someone glanced at the results and then left me alone for a very long time. Instead of being annoyed, I was relieved. I figured that if the EKG had found anything horrible, I wouldn't have been left by myself. I peeked at the results in my file, which seemed to indicate a few minor irregularities, but nothing that screamed imminent danger. But the technician had also taken a blood test, and when those results came in, everything changed. My blood contained an elevated level of troponine, a protein that the heart muscle releases when cells are injured. In other words, I was having, or had very recently had, a heart attack. Further testing showed that a number of my heart's blood vessels were almost completely blocked, meaning my heart muscle couldn't get enough blood and oxygen to function normally. A doctor showed up to say I'd been scheduled for a procedure to put stents in place to keep the blood vessel walls open. It was a minimally invasive procedure in which a tube carrying the stents would be threaded through my groin into my heart, where the stents would be placed to keep the artery walls separate and open. That's when I called my husband to let him know what was happening. I woke up from that procedure only to find out that it hadn't taken place. The blockages in my arteries were all at intersections of blood vessels, and the stents couldn't be placed there. I would need to be transferred to another hospital for an emergency bypass procedure, open heart surgery. At this point, I should mention that I'm a medical journalist. I've spent most of my career writing about health, often specifically about women's health. I know very well that heart disease is the leading cause of death in women and men in the United States. I also know what the major risk factors are, so I erroneously believed I didn't need to worry. I don't smoke. I didn't have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, or high blood sugar. I had even lost a fair amount of weight about a year and a half earlier and had been working out regularly. My diet wasn't perfect, but it was pretty healthy. Since my numbers were good and I wasn't aware of a bad family history, I didn't think I was at high risk. My father did have a heart attack and bypass surgery, but that had happened when he was in his 70s. I was barely 60. Honestly, heart disease just hadn't been on my radar. Cancer was. Many, many members of my family over the generations had succumbed to cancer, often at very young ages. I was diligent about being tested for colon cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, skin cancer, etc. I thought I had everything under control. Ha! I arrived at the larger hospital after a middle-of-the-night transfer by ambulance. Somehow my husband, son, parents, and siblings were already there waiting for me. I briefly met the surgeon, who was about to put me on a heart-lung machine to keep me alive during the surgery. Through a sedative haze, I gazed at this man who would saw through my rib cage and hold my heart in his hands while sections of arteries from my left leg, removed just a few hours earlier, were sewn into my heart. The next thing I remember was waking up in the recovery room. I looked up at the wall and muttered that the date on the bulletin board couldn't possibly be right. And it wasn't. The nurse in charge immediately notified someone that I was awake and unusually alert. I was told to breathe into a plastic tube. "You have young lungs," remarked the nurse. "And apparently an old heart," I replied. But since my heart had just been revascularized, maybe it was now younger too. I was inordinately pleased to be the first one out of surgery that morning to be released from the post-op recovery area to a hospital room. And that's how I found myself lying in a hospital bed making mental lists of song titles containing the word heart. The next few days were uncomfortable, as I was constantly monitored and poked and connected to a series of tubes that made getting out of bed to use the bathroom a major project. I slept a lot and had incredibly vivid dreams that I still ponder. In one, I was attending a party, and the Olympic gymnast Mary Lou Retton was one of the guests. "Oh my gosh, I admire you so much. You're so strong," I gushed. "Oh no, you're the strong one," she replied. It doesn't take a psychiatrist to figure out what that dream meant. In another, I was alone at night in a beautiful Italian plaza ringed by gorgeous white marble buildings. Projected on the buildings were repeating images from the famous Japanese woodblock, The Great Wave, by the artist Hokusai. It was the most beautiful place I'd ever been, and I remember feeling as if I never wanted to leave. I've since wondered if that dream was the kind of near-death experience that people have spoken about, though as far as I know, I was never near death while I was in the hospital. A few days after surgery, all the tubes were removed, the doctors were assured my vital signs were good, and the in-house rehab specialist was satisfied that I was capable of walking on my own. I was released to go home. My husband drove while I sat in the back seat as instructed, clutching a pillow over my chest for protection. After days of holding in my emotions and focusing on survival, I sobbed violently for the entire drive home. I was tempted to take it easy for a while, but my husband had a different agenda. First on the list, a walk in the park. Though I'd always loved walking, I felt weak and unsteady. No matter, my husband suggested we make at least one circle of the park, a half mile. The next day, it was an entire mile. Apparently, I was now signed up for his idea of a recovery plan. But I'm grateful to him for encouraging me. When the visiting nurse came to assess my post-surgery needs, she stated I would probably need a walker. She asked if I'd show her how I went up and down the stairs. I sprinted up and down as fast as I could. No more walker talk. As soon as I was eligible, just over a month past surgery, I began cardiac rehab at the local hospital. Once again, I realized my medical reporting had not really given me an accurate picture of heart disease patients and survivors. I thought that I, petite and not yet thinking of myself as old, would be exercising alongside much older and larger men. But the reality was quite different. There was a tall, slim, and very chic woman who had gone to her dentist complaining of a toothache and jaw pain. When he couldn't find anything wrong, he told her to go to the emergency room immediately. Yep, she'd had a heart attack too. There was a young-ish man who refused to let what happened change his image of himself as an outdoorsy, athletic, macho man. He always tried to lift the heaviest weights available. There was a tiny older lady who was always accompanied by her very attentive husband. She struggled to lift even 2-pound weights and saw this as just one more medical problem to deal with, since she had so many. We became a rather eclectic and mutually supportive workout group. We took turns on different exercise machines, but no one walking into the room would mistake it for a regular gym. For one thing, all of us had electrodes stuck to different parts of our chest. A wall of video screens transmitted the data to the nurses and rehab specialist who worked with us. Proud of my fast walking, I would speed up on the treadmill until one of the nurses would yell at me to slow down. I couldn't convince her of how good it felt just to be able to move that way again. Each time someone in the group completed the program, there was a small celebration, complete with a graduation certificate and healthy refreshments. As my body healed, my mind struggled to come to terms with what had happened. How could I trust my body again? Without someone monitoring my heart, would I ever be able to exercise or even walk without worrying it would happen again? The physical part of cardiac rehab was great, but why wasn't there a psychological component? After the elation of surviving, I felt the aftermath of having to come to terms with what was a changed, and I hope not diminished, self. I'm very fortunate that the surgery and rehab went well, that there was little to no damage to my heart muscle, and that I'm now considered healthy. I take all my medications diligently. I was a Girl Scout, including a statin to keep my cholesterol low, a beta blocker to keep my blood pressure low, and a low-dose aspirin to help prevent blood clots. I will probably have to take these medications for the rest of my life. I've also changed my diet to be even healthier, but still not perfect. Carbs. I shopped around until I found the right cardiologist for me, and I see her for a blood test and physical exam every 6 months. There are no restrictions on my activities. Before I left the hospital, I had asked the doctor if I could start training for a marathon if I wanted to. When he replied yes, I said, "Well, I don't really want to, but it's good to know I could." I've tried to understand why it happened, but no one has been able to give me an answer except to posit that genetics were probably involved. And I have since learned that there was more heart disease than I was aware of on my mother's side. But there is no fair in medicine. Plenty of people practice healthy lifestyles and still wind up with chronic illnesses. Others eat bacon cheeseburgers and slather butter on bread and don't find themselves in the hospital. I know far too many people who died far too young without having done anything that would explain what happened to them. I know that in spite of having had a heart attack, I am lucky. But one overwhelming feeling I have is that I was an idiot. Knowing what I knew as a medical journalist, why did I assume that I wasn't at risk of one of the biggest killers of women? What made me think I was an exception? That's really why I'm writing this essay, to try to convince everyone, everywhere, not to neglect their heart health, and not to assume that because they eat well and exercise, they're never going to have a problem. Everyone should be aware of their cardiac risk factors, including family history, and see their physician for an annual exam, usually covered by insurance, that includes an assessment of cardiovascular health. For more information on keeping your heart healthy, go to the website for the American Heart Association, heart.org, and click on Healthy Living. It's been more than 6 years since that perfect day in New York City turned into one of the worst days of my life. I think almost daily about what happened. It's not because of the way I feel. I feel absolutely fine and healthy. It's that I am reminded every morning and evening when I take my medicines and every time I eat out with friends and have to turn down the foods I know I shouldn't eat. I'm reminded, too, when I shower and dress in the morning and note the 8-inch scar, barely visible anymore, down the middle of my chest. But these things are also daily reminders of how good I feel, how lucky I was to get good medical care, and how much I appreciate my wonderful husband and son, my fabulous parents and siblings, and my incredible friends, who all helped me navigate the months after the surgery. I'm also grateful for how much I learned from an experience I desperately wish had not happened. Most of all, I feel privileged that, as a journalist, I can use my experience to get this message out to as many people as possible, and, I hope, prevent the same thing from happening to others. As for me, I'm determined that my heart will go on for a long time to come. That was My Heart Will Go On by Melinda Lawrence. And now for something very different from the Word Power section. This is a questionnaire for your knowledge of vocabulary. Since 1912, the Girl Scouts have instilled 3 C's in their youngsters: courage, confidence, and character. This issue's words are all inspired by those positive and praiseworthy traits. Are you a smart cookie with the can-do spirit to match? Listen to all 15 questions, and then at the end, I'll give you the correct answers. Number 1. Pluck. P-L-U-C-K. Does that mean A, cleverness, B, courage, C, useful skill? Number 2. Exemplar. E-X-E-M-P-L-A-R. Does it mean A, protector, B, role model, or C, peacemaker? Number 3. Benevolent. V-O-L-E-N-T. Does that mean A, modest, B, responsible, or C, kind? Number 4. Staunch. S-T-A-U-N-C-H. Does that mean A, brave, B, loyal, or C, diligent? Number 5. Largesse. L-A-R-G-E-S-S-E. Does it mean flexibility, B, self-esteem, or C, generosity? Number 6. Clement. C-L-E-M-E-N-T. Does that mean A, merciful, B, disciplined, or C, independent? Number 7. Ethos. ETHOS. Does that mean A, grace, B, insight, or C, principles? Number 8, articulate. ARTICULATE. Does that mean A, well-spoken, B, well-read, or C, well-rounded? Number 9, gumption. GUMPTION. Does that mean A, drive, B, gratitude, or C, honesty? Number 10, stalwart. STALWART. Does it mean A, open-minded, B, strong and steady, or C, prepared? Number 11, acumen. ACUMEN. Does it mean A, motivation, B, good judgment, or C, natural talent? Number 12, foursquare. FOURSQUARE. Does it mean A, straightforward, B, dependable, or C, knowledgeable? Number 13, moxie, MOXIE. Does it mean A, optimism, B, sincerity, or C, energy? Number 14, intrepid, INTREPID. Does it mean A, worldly, B, resourceful, or C, fearless? And finally, number 15, composure, COMPOSURE. Does that mean productivity, B, calmness, or C, tolerance? Okay, now for the answers. Pluck means B, courage. It takes pluck to stand up to a bully. Number 2, exemplar, means B, role model. Mr. Russo is an exemplar for all teachers, creative, patient, and adaptable. Number 3, benevolent. It means C, kind. When I lost my dog, Sadie, a benevolent neighbor helped me find her. Number 4, staunch. The answer is B, loyal. Gordon is a staunch supporter of his local public radio station. Number 5, largesse. The answer was C, generosity. How can we ever thank you for your largesse? Number 6, clement. The answer was A, merciful. The clement judge threw out my parking ticket when she saw my record of community service. Number 7, ethos. The answer was C, principles. Using recycled materials is part of our business ethos, the CEO said. Number 8, articulate. The answer was A, well-spoken. Juliet didn't talk until she was 3, but she has grown into an articulate, outgoing teenager. Number 9, gumption. The answer was A, drive. A political novice, Moira won the mayoral election through pure gumption. Number 10, stalwart. The answer was B, strong and steady. Tired of waiting for a stalwart hero to rescue her, the clever princess outsmarted her captors and freed herself. Number 11, acumen. The answer was B, good judgment. Hakim's financial acumen was apparent from a young age, starting with his profitable childhood lawn mowing business. Number 12, foursquare. The answer was A, straightforward. Never one to sugarcoat, Ezra gave his foursquare opinion of his sister's dramatic new haircut. Number 13, moxie. The answer was C, energy. I just don't have the moxie for a 5 a.m. kickboxing class. Number 14, intrepid? The answer was C, fearless. Only a handful of intrepid climbers have summited Mount Everest in winter. And finally, number 15, composure. The answer was B, calmness. As an ER doctor, Juana can keep her composure in stressful situations. So, how did you do? Vocabulary ratings, if you got 9 or fewer, that's rated as a daisy. 10 to 12, brownie. If you were correct with 13 to 15 of them, you are a scout. And finally, just a little bit of humor to close out today's program from All in a Day's Work. In my new supervisory position, I noticed that one of my direct reports wasn't meeting job expectations. In his first year, he had already received 2 professional improvement plans, or PIPs. I asked the company president if there was a limit on how many PIPs one could receive. "There is," he said. "We use the Gladys Knight rule. 3 PIPs." That was by Roger Anderson from Roseville, California. A firefighter spoke to my sister-in-law's first grade class about fire safety. As an introduction to the concept of stop, drop, and roll, he asked the children, "What would you do if your clothes were on fire?" One little boy said, "I wouldn't put them on." That was by Annalyn Smith, San Antonio, Texas. And lastly, during a job interview, the hiring manager asked me what my greatest weakness was. I panicked and blurted, "Donuts." He stared at me. I stared at him. Finally, he nodded and said, "Same." By Jonathan Frankel from Washington, D.C. We have now run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.